Patrick Lamb is a well-known Chicago-based attorney. He is a partner in the Valorum Law Group. Listen as Patrick and Ed discuss value billing.
Well, I have the pleasure today of talking with Patrick Lamb, and he's an attorney in the Chicago area, a well-known individual who, among other things, is a great proponent of value billing. Pat, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here, Ed.
Now, you recently were with a reasonably well-known firm, and I'm not sure if it was well-known because of you or because it's just an outstanding law firm, which it is. But you also, as of the beginning of the year, I think it was, started your own practice. Tell me why you felt it was necessary to move from the larger law firm to your own law firm as you are now.
Well, it really boils down to two things. One is my belief that the economic model that drives most law firms, which is hourly billing, is just a fundamental disservice to clients, and as the economy has worsened, it's become a bigger problem. And the other issue is in the same general area, which is most law firms really don't focus on client service, and even though they say they do, they don't really, and I just think it needs to be the center point of what a law firm does. And so I found a couple of people who shared that philosophy, and together we started Valorum.
And the law firm you started is an interesting name. It's Valorum, V-A-L-O-R-E-M. Is that Valorum Group or just Valorum Law Firm?
We go by Valorum Law Group, and of course, Valorum is Latin for value, so it says right in the name what our focus is.
And of course, that means that the Illinois Rules of Professional Conduct allow you to use a name in the law firm that is not just the surnames of the individuals.
Right. There's a restrictions on some advertising and how we have to do that, but fortunately we were able to avoid the issues that go along with trying to name a law firm after people.
And without intending or wanting to knock your previous law firm, what was it about their mentality that you felt you could not persuade them to move more closely to value billing and service orientation? I'm interested in the mentality of what really is the mainstream of the American lawyer.
My prior law firm, Butler Rubin, is an outstanding firm. Outstanding lawyers, I mean, they're just... I often joked when I was there that when they hired me, they lowered the average IQ of the place by a lot. I mean, really talented people. They are, as a group, I would say, very traditional in their approach to the business of the practice of law. And about a little over a year ago, over New Year's weekend, I was at the Renaissance weekend in Charleston, South Carolina, and I happened to find myself sitting at a break next to Ted Sorensen, who had advised presidents and was President Kennedy's main speechwriter and somebody I've long looked up to. And through the course of our conversation, he ended up offering me a piece of advice, which was that I needed to decide whether I wanted to spend my time and energy getting my current firm, to move toward the vision that I had, or whether I just wanted to be in the space that I wanted to be in. And it was an epiphany for me. And I came back and just said, look, I have to create the space that I want to be in. The energy and effort to get my former colleagues to move, certainly would have been a worthwhile investment, but they were never going to be prepared to go as far as I wanted to go, and I figured I had one shot at doing this, and so we started the planning for Valorum at that point.
Okay, so now you've made the move, and you have the infrastructure, and you're sitting by the phone waiting for clients to call. How is it that you got clients to understand and accept the principles of value billing?
Well, first of all, each of the – there are now four partners that are involved in this, and each of us had varying degrees of business that moved in. So the nice thing – moved with us. So the nice thing is that we didn't have to sit around on day one waiting for the phone to ring. But we've talked with most of those clients, and while we still do some hourly work, and I'm sure we'll do some hourly work for some period of time, we were able to work out alternative fee arrangements with several of the main clients that moved with us. And as we have talked with others and have attracted new clients, you know, we offer kind of the same pitch to all of them that. And they've basically found it attractive, which is we want to be paid for results, not hours. We want to help provide them budgetary certainty so that they can better manage their practice and department in very difficult economic times for many businesses. And they've responded to that very simple message.
And so... in terms of percentages of your billable time, would you say you're now close to, say, 80% value billing, 20% hourly billing, or is it still heavily in the hourly billing arena?
I'm actually waiting for a report to tell us where we are on that issue as of the end of March, but based on where we were after 2 months, and what my, you know, gut is telling me about March, I'd say we're probably pretty close to 50-50.
Okay. And moving toward more value orientation.
Correct.
Well, you've used a couple of phrases that I'd like you to define for our listeners that I think are critical in understanding what you're doing and what this whole topic is about. And you and I have talked about this in the past a bit, but you've used the terms value billing and then as well alternative fee arrangements. How would you define these two terms? Let's start with value billing.
I think in the truest sense, value billing is the client determining the value it attributes to a certain piece of work, and either at the very outset or at some later point, having the fee tied to that value so that if something is not worth much at all, they're not going to pay much in the way of fees, regardless of how much time it takes to solve the problem for the client. So that value billing is really client-driven. The fixed fee concept is simply a way of defining an amount that we will be paid, and it can or cannot be tied to the value that the client receives. What we're trying to do is obviously have the client focus on value and then agree on a fee that relates to the value received. And indeed, each of our invoices contains a value adjustment line so that our invoice is actually a proposed fee. And then we encourage our clients to make whatever adjustment they need to make to feel comfortable that what they're paying reflects the value that they've received.
Okay. So you got your client saying, this is how much it's worth to me.
Right.
And when does that discussion take place? Do you do it before you sign your engagement agreement? Do you do it somewhere down the road?
We do it before we start doing any work because it's important for us to know that we're on the same page with the client in terms of expectations. We can't find ourselves in a situation where we think a fee, a likely fee in a matter is, say, $5,000, and the client thinks it's $1,000. I mean, just to pick two numbers out of the hat. We have to be on the same page, and discussion is the way we arrive at that common understanding.
And what happens if the client thinks it is the $1,000, but you think it's the $5,000? What happens then?
Well, I mean, we're now moving. We haven't had that issue, but the way we would handle it if it arises is to say, look, you know, here's why we think it's a fee at this level. Please, you know, help us understand your thinking so that we know why you think it's at a different level. And it may be that we've assumed certain things needed to be done that the client knows don't need to be done, or you know, that our understanding of the scope of work is different from what the client's expectations are. And either in that situation, we either end up moving together toward a number that we're both comfortable with, or we would, you know, have to tell the client that we're not the right firm for them in this situation because, you know, of our different understanding of the, you know, the value and the cost of the work that needs to be done.
Well, how do you deal with the issue of, if you will, CYA vis-a-vis the malpractice issues that might arise? I know in a previous conversation with assistant general counsel for a major aerospace firm a number of years ago, that she said the way she arrived at it with her law firm, which was a major national firm, she said that the law firm, just pulling numbers out of the air, wanted to do 20 depositions, and she thought that 6 of those depositions would not produce anything of any significance. So she didn't want to spend the money in legal fees to have them take those depositions. And the way that she approached it was kind of interesting to me at the time. She said, look, our company is in the business of making risk assessments every day. Every day we take risk. And so this is just one of maybe a different variety of risk, but it's still just a risk, and we're going to accept the risk that anything that might have come from these 6 depositions is our responsibility and not yours. How do you deal with that issue?
In each, I think the quality and quantity of communication you have with your client determines whether the risks in these situations are real or theoretical. If you take an engagement and go off on your own and show up at the end and say, here's the trial result, or here's the resolution that we think you should accept, and the client doesn't know what decisions have been made and why and so forth, you have problems and you need to be defensive in those situations. If you're talking on a regular basis and providing a constant flow of precise but good quality information, we're going to do this but not this. This we don't believe is necessary because it's on an issue that we're not focusing on. You know, here our trial theme is going to be this, et cetera. My experience has always been that inside lawyers understand that the resources that are being allocated are going to allow so many things to happen and not justify doing additional things, and that there is always risk associated with any decision that gets made in a lawsuit, but as long as they understand what the decisions are, why you're making certain recommendations, and have a voice in the decisions, I've never run into a problem where a client has expressed any reservation or concern. So I think the key is involving them in the strategizing, the decision-making, and so forth.
Well, I think you do this, at least in my experience, most effectively by creating the budget, which you referred to earlier when you talked about budgetary certainty. I know one of my clients had to write off some rather significant accounts receivable, brought me in to understand why and how that happened and to make sure it didn't happen again. And one of the things I came up with was a flow chart for litigation. I had never seen it done before, but I brought my industry experience, if you will, to the table, and we created a flow chart. And we found out that the client was not involved very much at all in that litigation. And so we, in the future, force-fed the communication by making sure that any time there was a legal fee contemplated to be in excess of $10,000, that a budget was created, the client was involved with the budget, and the client had to sign off on that budget, accepting, you know, our premises. Is that how you do it?
Our practice is, and our agreement with our clients is, we won't spend their money without their approval. And so what we do at the outset of an engagement is we have a very detailed list of information that we're looking for, ranging from where a case is pending, what's involved, how many documents, and other information that, frankly, we need in order to be able to estimate a fee that we think is appropriate for a given case. And we share that information back and forth with the client. Much of the information comes from them, things like the number of witnesses and where they are and how much travel will be involved and so forth. And we then create a proposed fee, or use it to create a budget. That information that we've obtained is in a type of questionnaire format so that we know what information we had. And if we find ourselves going over budget because we just misunderstood the significance of something, but we had that information available to us, that's really our problem, shouldn't be the client's problem. If, on the other hand, there's a new witness that nobody knew about or a new issue is introduced to the case that wasn't there before, then that forms the basis for a change order where we would go to the client and say, in light of this, we think we need to make these kinds of adjustments. Would you agree? And if they, you know, are not inclined to agree, that we help them understand the risks of saying, look, you know, that was not part of our scope of engagement. If we don't take these depositions of these new witnesses, here's what might happen at trial, and here's how you could be put in an adverse position as a result of that. And the key in all of these arrangements, in my experience, that is trust between lawyer and client and an understanding that you both have to be working together for the common objective of the best result the client wants. And as long as everybody's pulling their oar in that direction, these things tend to work out, work themselves out, and we just haven't had any issue. I think, again, if you're a client and you're surprised by something, an after-the-fact, an invoice after-the-fact that's higher than you expected, that's when you start running into problems, and that's what we work very hard to avoid.
Well, one of the things you said, which triggers an interest on my part, is that you said you estimate the fee. In other words, this is not just a client decision. This is not just a client saying to you, you know, I don't want to spend more than X dollars, or I think it's worth Y dollars, or something of that nature. You start the conversation, in a sense, by estimating the fee and then having the conversation from there. So my question is, how do you estimate the fee? Is this based on number of hours you think it's going to take, or do you actually get into your contemplation of what the result will be and say, well, they have to have a return on their investment, so if we think this is worth $1 million to them, we're going to take 10% of it because that will give them an ROI of 10. How do you estimate the fee?
We have a little crystal. What you pointed out is an issue. How much time we think it might take is an issue. The likely result certainly certainly plays a significant role when we are proposing a fee where our compensation is adjusted depending on the result that's obtained. And so it varies dramatically from matter to matter, client to client. But one of the fundamental starting points is, and it's not really how many hours, it's really how much, hours is kind of too small of a measuring stick for litigation that might go on for 2 years. And so the question is this, you know, a case that's going to require two lawyers to spend two-thirds of their time on a matter? And if so, what's the cost that we're facing for something like that, and what kind of return do we need internally? What's our internal rate of return need to be in order to justify allocating those resources in that manner? And that usually gives us a ballpark of the kind of number that we need to have for that case. And sometimes, you know, it relates to, in the client's mind, to how many hours we'll spend on it. But, we really try not to do that because, again, if you have a hourly rate that's way off the charts, you can really drive up those costs. And we're, again, trying to avoid tying things to hours.
Well, if you don't tie it to hours, and I hear what you're saying, that that's only, or an aspect of that is only one element to consider, are you looking at a contingency type of practice? Are you looking for a percentage of recovery as an element in this conversation?
Our most preferred fee is what I call a fixed fee with either a holdback or a bonus, depending on results. So that we have, and what this is, it's kind of a hybrid of a number of different fee structures that tends to take away some of the risk and temper some of the reward that might be tied to a pure contingency or just a pure simple fixed fee concept. But generally our approach is we need to cover our costs so that we can afford to operate our business. Then we want to do better if we succeed for the client, and we want to understand that we'll do worse from a fee standpoint if we don't succeed for the client. And so that's why the kicker or the holdback puts money that into a bonus bucket, if you will, and the client has discretion at the end of the case based on either we agree to just leave it entirely in their discretion or if we agree to benchmarks by which we'll be evaluated, but the client would be the judge at the end of the process as to whether we get none of that bucket, some of that bucket, or multiples of that bucket.
Well, one of the things that's really important that I take away from this last comment is that in your conversation with the client, you've got to have a discussion about what the benchmarks of success look like. Just getting a judgment or just delaying a defense verdict or something of that nature may or may not be what the client is thinking of in terms of success, and you've got to understand that. Am I right?
Absolutely. We go back to that value adjustment line that we include in every bill. It's critical for us to understand exactly what the client wants so that we're giving them what they want so that when they have their pen in hand and sit down to decide whether to adjust that fee, that they are inclined not to do that as opposed to feeling the need to make a downward adjustment.
And here we're talking not just the needs as perceived by the lawyer, but the wants as perceived by the client.
Absolutely. At the end of the day, it's all about what the client wants. And, you know, I might want a case to go to the Supreme Court because then I have the benefit of arguing a case at, you know, the highest court in the country. But there are very few clients who would define that as a business objective in any lawsuit that they're involved in. And so it's unlikely that getting the case to the Supreme Court would – ever be something that would justify some kind of a bonus. On the other hand, it may be that they want to have a matter gone and resolved before the next reporting period. And so that becomes an issue that where you want to work a case very hard and very quickly in order to achieve that result. So there's all sorts of things that may have nothing to do with the actual outcome that's achieved that can go into success. It's, you know, really a matter of getting the client to spend the time to evaluate a particular case in the context of their business and going from there.
I'm sensitive to your time, Pat, and I don't want to take you too far afield, but one of the things that you've said that I think is crucial in underlies the entire conversation and the whole concept of value billing is this issue of trust between the lawyer and the client. And I'm wondering how you see that issue in the context of your practice and how you can quickly develop the trust that's necessary to implement the concept of value billing and alternative fees when you don't know the person before this current experience. How do you develop that trust? How do you create the trust?
Well, that's the $64 question or the $64,000 question, depending on what multiples you want to use.
But or what era you admit to coming from.
Exactly. It is, I mean, a relationship between a lawyer and his or her client is all about trust. And we try to demonstrate our trust in the client once we accept an engagement. And we do it tangibly every month by saying to the client, here's the pen, you adjust the bill if you think you need to, and whatever you adjust it to, that's what will be due. And so, you know, we then want to earn their trust each month by giving them not only great service, but great results, and doing the things that are necessary to meet whatever individual needs they have. If a client's got a budget issue and we can work with them in a way which accommodates that concern, we're absolutely going to be doing it. So it really is a matter of communication, asking direct questions, getting information, and understanding also that, you know, every lawyer should not accept every piece of business. I mean, there are some times where, you know, people don't, their personalities don't mesh, and so it's not the right, you know, right relationship. And if it's not right for me, maybe it's right for one of my partners, or maybe it's not right for our firm at all, and we want to help them find somebody else, you know, who can provide a better relationship with them.
Well, once you've taken on a case and you start building the trust, what you've talked about thus far is how the lawyer creates the trust environment. Have you ever been involved where, I'm not quite sure how to say this, but where the client violates the trust that the client should be creating with the lawyer?
You know, I suspect every lawyer's had a situation where a client hasn't been entirely forthcoming, or, you know, has a dirty little secret that's important to the case, but they don't want to disclose it, or whatever. Those situations, I think, are few and far between, and you know, when they arise, you need to decide how important the breach of trust is, and if it's significant to the lawyer, I think you either, you know, tell the client that you don't want to go forward, or you finish the matter you're working on and then, you know, simply find other work to do going forward.
Look, we've come to the end of our time in this interview. I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Glad to be here, Ed.
You have been listening to a Law Biz podcast. For more podcasts, please visit www.lawbiz.com/podcasts.html. Feel free to tell your friends and colleagues about Law Biz podcasts. You may duplicate this program in part or in whole, provided that you retain appropriate attribution and copyright notices.